So as we turn to this week's Parsha, Parsha Shoftim, we undergo somewhat of a shift from last week's Parsha Re'eh that had the beginnings of acclimatizing the Jewish people to the fact that they were going to have autonomy. They were going to enter a land. They needed to come face to face with the possibility of how to structure their national lives. And the primary theme, the thrust we saw last week, was essentially ridding the land of idolatry, which will repeat itself at various junctures in this week's Parsha, where it is seen as so crucial that the foundations of national life are rooted in monotheism and the monotheistic imagination, which we spent some time at the end of last week detailing why it's so important. It's not just egotism on the part of God that everything needs to be about him, but there's a recognition that monotheistic belief entails ethical consequences. The believing that there is a single being that controls and generated the cosmos tells you about human integrity, about purpose in the universe, in a way that pagan polytheism rips apart and opens the door to moral relativism, competition, aggression, seeing other people as embodiments of evil, as products of a foreign god, whatever the case may be. But the foundation has to be a belief in a singular god, which repeats itself in our parsha, as I said on occasion. But there is a noticeable shift when you get to Parsha Shoftim, where it begins to speak in very human terms, not about the theological underpinnings of civilization, but the technical workings of a functional society. We get a description of the role of the priest in terms of not just the ritual order, as we saw in Vayikra, but how he functions as engaging the population. We've got a priest, a description of the prophet, which Moshe goes into detail, suggesting, I'm really the first prophet. It's true that there were visions that the Avot and Imahot had, but in terms of instructions from on high, how to that needed to be communicated to others, Moshe is really the first figure. And he says the door is now open to an era of prophecy. There will be prophets after me. And this is how they should be integrated into society. Then we've got the priest, the prophet. We've got a description of the king, really for the first time in any great detail, which describes limits on the king's power. Who can be king, which is a somewhat, in modern context, controversial subject, and actually the source of much controversy in terms of leadership roles, even in contemporary Jewish life. And so we'll come to the king as well. And we've got the judge. Most centrally in Parashat Shoftim, the judge, you've got the priest, the prophet, the king, and the judge, four institutional representatives who are given description. And along the way, we've got details. How courts ought to run, how the temple ought to run, how the kingdom under the reign of a monarch ought to run, and how civic life ought to run. We'll have details that will come through. So let's begin at the beginning. Shoftim v'shotrim tiyeh titen lecha b'chol sha'arecha, you shall appoint shoftim, which are judges. What is shotrim? What is a shoter? Anybody know?
Policeman.
Police, right? It translates usually as officer. Bailiff. An officer. Say again, Diane?
Bailiff.
A bailiff, it's some of the translators. A bailiff or an officer, functionally, is an enforcer of the court. So that may be police, depending on the jurisdiction. Sometimes if it's federal court, that would be the FBI who are enforcing the court's verdicts. It depends on the context. But that's what shoter is. And there is this implicit recognition that law is meaningless if there aren't mechanisms of enforcement. And that's really the state that Jewish life has occupied for 2,000 years. Since the temple was destroyed and we were sent into diaspora, we had to try to organize Jewish life without mechanisms of enforcement. There were moments in the medieval period where Jews were given free rein to organize themselves, very odd arrangements where Jews paid a special tax. They lived in a foreign country, whether it was in Spain, Provence, Northern France, Eastern Europe, and they were given what was called the Kahal. They were given rights as Jews to organize their own affairs, to run criminal trials of their own. it's true that if Jews were accused of crimes against natives of Eastern Europe, they would be taken, obviously, when given due process. But within Jewish life, if there was a case that needed to be settled, Jews had permission from the monarch, usually, to organize their own criminal proceedings. And this meant, to the extent that in some countries in the medieval period, Jews carried out the capital punishment. And we tend to presume capital punishment wasn't carried out since the temple period. But there were times, it wasn't the official halachic capital punishment, one of the four mechanisms that involved going to a certain place, but there were executions that were carried out by Jewish religious courts in the medieval period under their own jurisdiction. So there were moments where we could enforce Jewish law, but as it stands now, people tend to get run-ins with the FBI if they want to enforce Jewish law. There was a case 3 years ago and probably 4 years ago and probably 8 years ago in New Jersey where there were bailiffs going around to solve the Aguna crisis. What's the Aguna crisis? Anyone familiar?
A woman wants a recalcitrant husband,
as it's termed, a husband who refuses to give a get in a situation where the marriage has fallen apart, the couple is not living together, and for no reason discernible other than revenge, spite, or exploitation, the husband refuses to give a get so that his wife cannot remarry, cannot move on. And that's what's called the Aguna crisis. She is ma'agen, she is chained. And really, halachically speaking, there are very few resolutions to this problem. There are cases of agunot, where husbands refuse to give a get, where all we can do is arrange protests outside the recalcitrant husband's place of work, place of residence. We tell all the shuls not to give them aliyot. We tell all the shuls not to give them honors. And that can be effective, but often is not that effective. So there are essentially two routes in modern life that have been deemed effective at getting a get out of a husband when marriages have broken down. And what are the two routes, the two most effective routes? Anyone know one effective route? Okay, so we're in trouble if we don't have any effective routes. So there are two. One effective route is what is called the halachic prenup, which probably didn't really come onto the scene till about a decade, maybe 15 years ago, which is a document that is written, approved by the Beit Din of America, that commits a husband. You can do a postnup after marriage as well. Now, most OU or RCA Young Israel rabbis will refuse to officiate a wedding without a halachic prenup. It has been deemed the most effective means to date to stop any aguna problems, which is a husband and wife sign this document in advance of a wedding, which is a commitment on the husband's part that if a marriage has fallen apart to the extent where they're not living together as a couple, there's no hope of rekindling the relationship. They've given up on the relationship. They're not in the middle of counseling. And there's no hope. The husband agrees to pay a certain amount of money towards his wife's welfare every day. And that's calculated at, I don't know, $200 a day or something, which doesn't sound like a huge amount on the face of it. But of course, 200 times 365 times in perpetuity adds up. And there is a financial incentive to give a get. And there has been, since this has been on, I wouldn't say on the market, but since it's been in action over the last 15, maybe 20 years, there has been zero cases of an aguna. And there have been, of course, marriages that have fallen apart that have led to divorce, but there have been zero cases of recalcitrant husbands who have left an aguna situation. So that's been proven to be the most effective means. I should note that it is not universally accepted across the halachic spectrum. I don't know if right-left is a helpful distinction here, but all the way, I guess, we will use that distinction on the right. There are communities or halakhic authorities that say that the prenup violates the rules of a halachic wedding, because it conditions a kiddushin, and a kiddushin, a wedding that is taken conditionally, doesn't work. Having said that, Rav Shechter, Rav Willig, Rav Asher Weiss, mainstream and esteemed halachic poskim think it's not only legitimate, it's necessary, no one should officiate a wedding without it. That's the most effective. What is the second most effective mechanism to get a husband to give a get? It doesn't involve signing anything.
Threatening him with his life.
Yeah. Right. The expression you find in Maimonides citing the Talmud is kofin oto, you force them, ad sheyomer, until he says, rotzani, I want to, which is translated roughly into English as brute force. And we don't always wait for them to say, I want to. But this is, again, thinking about the medieval period when they did enforce Jewish law in certain segments of the Jewish world, this is how they had bailiffs who would enforce it, which meant you could physically accost somebody. And 5 years ago, you're looking up on Google, 5 years ago, segments of the Haredi community in New Jersey may have been associated with one of the yeshivot there, but I won't name it because I don't know and I don't want to cast aspersions. But the FBI arrested a whole group of what they called religious zealots and thugs who were going around beating men for not giving their get to their wife. Now, this was inspired to protect the rights of women, which is not something the Haredi world is often accused of trying to do. So this was trying to defend the rights of women to move on, to live in dignity, to separate once a marriage has fallen apart. But of course, the means to which they were pursuing this ends was beating people up as vigilantes outside the law, which is, of course, prohibited in American law. So not, of course, to judge whether that, well, we should judge that was improper, inappropriate, illegal. But it demonstrates the point that Jewish life without shoterim, without bailiffs or enforcers, really has its hands tied behind its back. If we were living in a halachic state, I wouldn't say that shoterim would be empowered to go around and beat people, but we would have policemen who could arrest people. Now, in the United States, you can't arrest a husband for not giving a get. You can't jail or sentence a husband for not giving a get. In a halachic state, that would be something with shoterim you could do. And that would mend what is often seen as a virulently anti-modern part of Jewish life, where women don't get get. So Judaism and Jewish life and halacha is innately anti-feminist, anti-woman, and all the power goes to the men. Now, of course, in a halachic society, you wouldn't just have shoftim who tell you the halacha, you'd have shoterim who could enforce that and say, no, we're here to defend the rights of women, and if you refuse to give a get, we will jail you. So that's why it's so central to have a shoter. And actually, Rishon of this week's parsha, where we have the description of the judges and the officers, for one of the medieval major authorities, thinkers, theologians, Rabbeinu Nissim, often known as the Run, Rabbeinu Nissim, he sees in our Rishon, in one of the Psukim, the origins of what's now called the separation of powers. And he was writing at a time when Europe writ large was coming to terms with separation of powers, because traditionally in 12th century Europe, who decided the fate of, who gave verdicts? Who decided the fate of the population in 12th century Europe, would you guess?
The church.
Okay, so it was either the church or the church were deputized, depending on who had the power at the time. It wouldn't be the church, it would be the king. The monarch, right? And there were times in history when the church had more power than the king, and there were times when the king had more power than the church, and there were different areas in Europe. But there weren't a judiciary that made decisions that had independent protection from the monarch. Some of the vernacular in English life or United Kingdom, British life, has echoes of this, where currently, what are the judges on the Supreme Court in the United States called? Anybody know? In the United States, what are the judges who sit on the bench in the Supreme Court? What are they referred to? What's their title?
Justices.
They're justices, right? And in the UK, that is currently the case too. There is a Supreme Court, and the judges who occupy seats on that court are called Supreme Court justices. That did not changed. That was not the case until about 5 years ago. Before 5 years ago, the judges on the Supreme Court of the United Kingdom, which was not called the Supreme Court, but something else, they had a different title. Anyone know what they were called? And it sounds like something out of jail.
Barristers?
So barristers are a kind of lawyer in London. You have a difference between a barrister and a solicitor. A solicitor often does paper law, paperwork, contract law, and barristers speak in court. So that's a distinction within the law profession. But the judges had a different name. And it sounds antiquated, which is to some degree why they changed it. They were called the Law Lords, because they were part of the House of Lords who served as judges. They were called the Law Lords, which, and of course, if you're a lord, that means you serve under the monarch. You are in the hierarchy of the executive branch. And recently, to kind of account for the fact that that vernacular didn't fit with modern British society, they changed it to be Supreme Court judges. But the Ran Rabbeinu Nissim sees in our parsha the beginning of the separation of powers, which didn't come to full fruition until a couple of centuries ago in the West. And this is where he sees it, because we're told you should have shotim v'shoftim b'chol sha'arecha in all your gates. V'shaftu et ha'am mishpat tzedek, and they should judge the people mishpat tzedek. How do you translate those two words? You have to judge the people mishpat tzedek. How would you translate that?
Righteous law.
It sounds redundant. You should say shaftu et ha'am mishpat. Judge the people with justice. What is mishpat tzedek? With righteous justice. What are we trying to preclude the judges from doing? If it wouldn't have said the word tzedek, it would have just said shaftu et ha'am mishpat. What might we miss if it didn't say the
showing
word
favor.
Tzedek? Say again.
Showing favor to one party.
Interesting. So it may just be
the rich or poor. You shouldn't show favor to everybody. Should be treated equally. The rich, the poor, the old, the young, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. So to some degree, that's the view of the Tanchuma, the Medrash. It doesn't say et cetera, et cetera. It says v'chula v'chula at the end. But yes, it does take the view that mishpat on its own does not necessarily indicate justice in the strict righteous sense. It just bespeaks resolution. A mishpat is just a judgment, but it doesn't mean that it's a just judgment. And in theory, say again, Saul?
Jurisprudence.
Yeah, it just means a court resolution, a mandate from a judge. But mishpat tzedek suggests that the mandate has to be just. And the example the Midrash gives is, it says that the judge has to take stolen items away from thieves and return them to their owners, which seems astonishingly redundant. Of course it does. But there's a whole different argument in judicial theory, which is the court is not there to establish justice. It's there to establish something altogether different. It begins with P. What are courts there to achieve? Ends with Is. That's your only clue.
Peace.
Right? Meaning, if you've got an enforcement mechanism, meaning you've got police and you've got courts, in theory, the court could come to any determination it likes. The litigants have to accept the judgment, and peace. It reigns in society. You get judgments and you have to follow the judgments. But that might not be just. In fact, there are, of course, in the civil rights campaigns that were launched over the last couple of centuries in the United States, arguments were given about there's a difference between peace and a just peace. And in theory, under the reign of slavery in the South in the early 1800s, there was peace, right? Peace just means quiet, no fighting. It was peace, but it was an unjust peace where people were being held in that peaceful stasis in states of exploitation, inhumanity, indignity, and war is preferred to an unjust peace. And here we get that sense of mishpat tzedek means a just peace. And mishpat actually is closer to the word shalom in this context. And there are these two views in judicial theory and in Jewish thought, where what is the court achieving? Is the court achieving emet, or is the court achieving shalom? And that obviously the big distinction is shalom, peace just means it doesn't really matter whether the court got it right, as long as everybody obeys the verdict and keeps the court's orders. That's all the court is meant to do, keep everything in check, hear cases, produce results, make sure people move through the system. And it just has to produce shalom. However, that might not be emet. Now, there is a cost if you're going for emet and rather than peace. Because, I mean, here's an example that is very contemporary and may be provocative, but I don't mean it to be. There's been a lot of, excuse me, there's been a lot of attention given to the Supreme Court case in Israel, which is still going through the Supreme Court at the moment, concerning some residences in East Jerusalem held in Beit Jara, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. Anyone know the details of the case or know which case I'm talking about? In many ways, it was used in many ways as the fabricated justification by Hamas to launch an assault a few months ago in the war. And it was, the claim is, and if you look in the media generally, and I don't mean to say the MSM, the mainstream media, just if you look at the way it's simplified, things often are when communicated in mass media, it is the Jews want to evict, or the Israelis want to evict Palestinians out of their historical homes, and there's no legitimate argument to be made. And the Supreme Court has been sitting on it because they know it's an explosive thing that is easy to generate rage about. Now, the details of the case are, what is really the Supreme Court trying to decide? The Supreme Court is not trying to weigh in on whether Israel is Jewish or Palestinian. It is not getting in there. Anyone know what the details of the actual legal case they're trying to hear or deal with are?
The land was originally Jewish.
Right.
The 48 war was given
right.
Up.
So let's clarify. When you say originally Jewish, you don't mean, from the time of Joshua.
No.
What do you mean?
That over 100 years ago, there was a Jewish settlement there. People owned property.
And is this something that we just assume from anecdote?
No. It's deeds and it's well documented.
There you go. So there are deeds, legal signed deeds from British Mandate Palestine that show that the land there and the properties there are Jewish owned. Jews were not living there the whole time, but it was Jewish owned, occupied by Arab residents. In what kind of arrangement that we often have in apartment buildings all over the city? What's the arrangement?
Rent.
And they weren't paying their rent. That's why it started.
Right. And they have not
paid
rent.
That's how it started.
Right. And the current occupants of those homes have not paid rent, I think, for decades. And the landlords, Jewish landlords, want to evict tenants for not paying rent. That's what the whole case is about. What is the right of landlords to evict people who don't pay rent? I mean, you have cases like this every day in New York. Where people want to evict their tenants are not paying rent. And there are all sorts of protections to stop people from being evicted. Over the last year and a half, there have been more protections put in that essentially make it impossible as a landlord to evict somebody. But that's obviously changing. Moratoriums are ending. Also, it's a complex legal construct around ownership, property rights, squatter rights, all sorts of questions. Nothing to do with historically who owns this land. So if the Supreme Court of Israel was said, we're a court and our calling is to achieve emet, our purpose as a court is to issue laws and verdicts and results and orders that are based on truth. What is the inevitable, obvious answer to the case? Maybe not inevitable or obvious, but let's presume that if they've not paid rent for two decades, the landlord's got a right. What would the court rule? Out you get.
Either have to pay your rent or get out.
Right. Now, if the court said, well, actually, our role as judges of the court, as officers of the court, is not to achieve emet. You can never achieve emet. It is a false belief that judges can achieve truth. There are always uncertainties when you're dealing with controversies. There are always uncertainties when you're dealing with conflicts between litigants. There's evidence, but evidence is really just to make the best case. There's always speculation. There's always guess. There's always assumptions, always presumptions being made. We can't achieve emet. Our goal as a court is to achieve shalom, is to achieve peace. Now, of course, if we're achieving peace by just randomly picking names out of a hat to decide who's guilty and who's innocent, you're not actually going to have peace. There is going to be uproar. But you achieve peace by giving the most reasonable outcome based on the evidence in the larger context so that society can understand why the judges are making that decision. So that now becomes complicated, because if the Supreme Court judges in Israel know full well that truthfully, the legal case is almost inarguable that you need to evict these residents. But if they understand that if those residents are evicted, society will go up in flames, that there will be uproar in mixed Israeli-Arab towns and cities again, that the Muslim countries all around Israel will launch an assault, that there will be anti-Semitism around the world, that we won't be able to get a fair hearing in the street to say, this is just a case about rent and landlords. It's Jewish land. There are deeds. No one wants to hear that. It's going to be explosive. This is going to be part of the narrative of Jewish occupation and Jewish empiricism, where we're running all over the world, imperialism. So at that point, the court might say to themselves, we need to think about achieving a peaceful resolution rather than an emet-driven resolution. Now, here the judges in our parasha are being told, shaftueta am mishpat tzedek. You have to achieve a righteous judgment. Now, of course, what does righteous mean? Does it mean truthful? Does it mean peaceful? And there are going to be different exegetes who have read that differently. But what we see already coming to the fore in this description is justice is complicated. Justice is not just a matter of an abstract discussion in a law school about what's the right resolution legally, but what is my role as a judge? Is my role to come out with truth, or is my role to come out with justice? Now, having said that, Rabbeinu Nissim, who talks about separation of powers, views it differently than today. And he says Mishpat Tzedek means truth, emet. The role of the judge is not to get involved in societal calculations. The role of the judge is not to think about what's going to be the fallout. The role of the judge is not to think about what are the socio-political consequences of my rulings. The judge is a judge, and that is it. The judge looks at the text, the evidence, the case, and gives a verdict, a ruling that is a mishpat tzedek, that is the halacha, so to speak. Now, he acknowledges that that will lead often to impossible social situations. But that's why you've got the separation of powers. You've got the court and you've got the executive or the king. And what is the role of the king for the run, Rabbeinu Nissim? And it is an astonishing argument, radical, that troubled a number of his peers and many to this day that see him as radical. He says the king has the power to do what?
Wage war.
Well, the king has the power to wage war. That's true. Often that has to get the progenitor of the court as well. It has to sign on to that. But the king has the power to overrule the court in aid of social harmony. This is going to be his claim, which says, v'shaftu et ha-mishpat tzedek, the judges have no flexibility. They've got no freedom of decision to decide what is this going to do politically. If the Supreme Court of Israel was functioning by the role assigned by Rabbeinu Nissim, by the run, Mishpat Tzedek, you just have to give the truth. You have to promote the law. And in theory, for Rabbeinu Nissim, Israel's president is Herzog president already, or Reuven Rivlin still in? Anybody know?
Herzog
took over. So President Herzog, in the view of Reuven Rivlin, could come along to the court and say, that's fine, I'm overruling you, and I am legally enforcing a more peaceful solution. That's the way the run sees it, that the king, the monarch in Jewish thought, in the halachic state, has the power to overrule halacha and say, even though that is the halacha, even though the Sanhedrin has determined that that is the law, for the sake of social harmony, I am going to overrule it and enact a temporary stay on that ruling. Now, of course, that troubles some of the medieval commentators, because hold on a minute, it's either halacha or it's not. And you've now, in a bid to defend the integrity of the court, you've now smashed the integrity of halacha. The halacha, you say, doesn't always come into effect because the king can say that's not peaceful, that's not socially appropriate. And you'll have moments where the king can overrule and society will function non-halachically. Although, of course, in the broadest terms, the halachic system wants there to be this balance for the Rabbeinu Nissim, where there is an executive that balances out the strict law. And actually, the Rabbeinu Nissim used this argument in the medieval period to defend Jewish reputation, the reputation of Jewish life. Also controversially, because in the medieval period, a number of what was then, what was at the time beginning to modernize in Europe, when was the Magna Carta signed? Anybody know? Anyone know what the Magna Carta is?
1215,
just before lunch, indeed. The Magna Carta was signed in 1215. It was essentially the first document towards democracy. There are four original copies, I think, that exist in the world, one of which is in the National Archives in Washington, D.C., if I'm not mistaken. And it essentially, in 1215, began the road to representation, democracy, limits on the monarch. That's what it began. It was astonishing the monarch could have limits in law. Was unprecedented. I'm the king. And as Mel Brooks says, it's good to be the king. And in 1215, it became less good because there were limits on your power. And in that age, when this was happening, Rabbeinu Nissim living about 150 years later, Jewish religion, Jewish culture was seen as primitive, antiquated, in many ways as it is today by some in the secular sphere that see Jewish life as primitive, antiquated, outdated, old-fashioned. And Rabbeinu Nissim defended Jewish life by saying, you're right, it is outdated. But it's not outdated because it's primitive. It's outdated because we don't have an executive power right now. We only have judges or rabbis who sit on courts issuing halachic rulings according to the strict letter of the law. And that can often promote a social disharmony. If we had a king, if we had autonomy, if we had our own state, we would balance out the needs of society with halachic law and everything would be contemporary, just, and harmonious. So what Rabbeinu Nissim is doing, just by looking at one pasuk at the beginning of our parasha, it says, Shafto et ha'am mishpat tzedek, judge the people with tzedek justice, with righteous justice. He's saying the court has a very narrow, very limited role in social affairs. They just say, okay, they are in many ways closer to what in the American context would be Senate parliamentarians who are there simply to say, what is the regulation? What is the rule? But are not making larger social determinations. In fact, I'm sure there's a debate on the Supreme Court bench and in legal circles about what the role of the judge is in the federal context. And, you know, there are more what are called active judges who see their role as not just determining what constitutional law is on the matter, but interpreting what constitutional law might be in the modern context. And there are different views how they should function. And in many ways, it comes back to this basic question about the role of the judge and how much power a judge should have and whether that power should be balanced with other institutional branches. And that's the Rabbeinu Nissim, the medieval period it's in. He's got a series of drashot, which creatively was published in a work called Drashot Haran, the sermons of Rabbeinu Nissim, which are really essays. And it's the 11th essay, Drasha Yud Aleph, where he describes the separation of powers, the role of the judge, the role of the king, all on the basis of this one pasuk. And there's one extra word. If it would have just said, Shefto et ha'am mishpat, judge the people with justice, we wouldn't have had any exegetical controversy. There wouldn't have been a platform to discuss these matters. But that one word, mishpat tzedek, right at the beginning of our parsha, is the trigger point for this whole discussion. We're still in Rishon, so we didn't get too far. We've got a few minutes left. We then have the famous turn of phrase, tzedek, tzedek, terdof, justice, justice, you'll pursue. And you can imagine full well if the word mishpat tzedek was redundant and we got a whole world of judicial theory on the basis of that one word, tzedek, tzedek teridof, there is a repetition there, which also leads to a huge amount of commentary, interpretation, halachic and religious thought around why we're being told justice, justice, you'll pursue. And I guess at this point, I could ask you, why would the Torah say justice, justice, you'll pursue? Tzedek, 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 why repeat? Guesses, thoughts? What would you say if I put you on the spot? Why did it say justice twice?
Emphasis.
Emphasis. Okay, emphasis. So this is, in some ways, we would say that maybe poetry, poetic. And it is poetic. In fact, I think Ruth Bader Ginsburg passed away last year, I think now, 7 months ago. She had in her office in the Supreme Court the justice, justice you'll pursue, tzedek, tzedek, tiridof. And the very fact that it's found a place in art, it's found a place in books of quotes, is because it is poetic. Justice, justice you'll pursue. You can imagine it being quite a rousing sentence to an audience. But of course, our exegetical masters, our commentators over history have said, the Torah, though it is compelling as a spoken document, we read it every week, it is also compelling as a exegetical document, where it is not to be rousing or enthralling or inspiring, but is a condensed text where every word and every letter has more meaning. So tzedek, tzedek, tiridof, for the commentators, is not just, with the exception of maybe the Rashbam or the Radak, who see kefel lashon, repetition, as an emphatic rhetorical mechanism. The other commentators say, no, it's teaching something. The Ramban, Nachmanides, say tzedek, tzedek, tiridof is suggesting that we ought to pursue justice on two planes, on the material plane and on the spiritual plane. We ought to pursue justice on earth, and we ought to pursue justice in our spiritual endeavors as well. And that's just one example of numerous ways to read it. So either way, that's Risho, and there are more details about the court, more details about idolatry being prohibited, returning to the theme from last week, and also ideas about a Supreme Court, where if cases get too complicated locally, they get taken up to a court of appeals in the place that God will choose, meaning in Yerushalayim. It's 9:10, so I guess what I'll do is, instead of, I'll very quickly say, Sheni discusses the role of the king, which we can come to another time. Shlishi discusses the role of the Levi, his position or her position as a tribe. They don't have land. They live in certain cities. The gifts that are given to Kohanim are also in Shlishi, which include the cheekbone, the stomach, and the arm of animals, brought as korbanot. Number four, you've got more about the roles of the Levi. We're given the profound command that we are to be perfect, astonishing command, where we are told to be perfect by God. We are told, tamim ti el Hashem Elokecha, you shall be tamim to the Lord your God, which of course raises the question of what it means to be perfect. And there is a three-way debate between the Ibn Ezra, the Rambam, Maimonides, and Rashi, that sounded like four, but Rambam, Maimonides, same, on the question of what does it mean to be tamim? What does God want of us? We can't be perfect. Certainly during Elul, building into Rosh Hashanah, we recognize that we're not perfect. It is true that the Talmud reports that there were four people in history who never sinned, who never committed a single sin, a radical notion, which we can explore another time. But why? What does it mean to be tamim? Now, there is a time where the word tam comes up. Where does the word tam come up?
Nagada.
Excellent. So you could have gone with Yaakov, who's called an Ish Tam Yoshev Olim, or you could say the Haggadah, where we have the Chacham, the Rasha, the Tam, and Sheni Delishol. What does Tam mean in the context of the Haggadah?
Simple.
Usually it's translated as simple rather than perfect, right? Naive, maybe. Innocent might be the word. But it doesn't mean perfect in the sense that flawless. In fact, each of the four sons has a flaw. And the Tam is simple or naive. or superficial. And it's suggested by the Ibn Ezra that that's what we're told to be here. Be tamim l'Hashem Elokecha. Just be simple. Don't get twisted and contorted in theological crises. We're dealing in the Elul series on Monday nights for this week and the next 2 weeks on the question of theodicy, justifying evil in the world. And the Ibn Ezra says, just stop. Stop asking the question. Stop being troubled by it. Be tamim. Just accept naively. That's what tamim means. Now, for some, that could not be less our purpose on earth. For Maimonides, the Rambam, tamim, does have the connotation of perfect, of perfection, of flawlessness, that we are commanded to be flawless intellectually. For Maimonides, who is an intellectual elitist, and that's not meant in a pejorative way, just descriptive, Maimonides believed that really the route to God was through contemplation, was through study, and we are commanded to study. And if it's a question of theodicy or prophecy or creation or eternity or mortality, we have the obligation religiously to meditate and study these matters until we reach tamim, a sense of intellectual perfection, which is the opposite of the Ibn Ezra. And Rashi takes a different view. Tamim for him, he says that we shouldn't be shoel ala atid. We shouldn't start asking about the future, which doesn't mean that we should have no questions. We should accept everything naively, but it means that there should be a level of equanimity, that tamim, I guess we could translate it as composure, that you've got on the one hand, naivete commanded by the Ibn Ezra, intellectual perfection by Maimonides, and there's middle ground with Rashi, who suggests that we ought to have a level of intellectual, emotional, religious composure in life, where we recognize that we have questions, we can pursue them, but we shouldn't live in a state of suspense or suspension until we have the answers. We should be able to cope with life in a state of composure and be tamim, which I guess we could say maybe for him, excuse me, means innocent and uncomplicated. So those are ways of reading Revi. Chamishi, we'll finish up now. It's 9:15. Chamishi, we get to the role of the prophet. We read about the cities of refuge, which is another subject we could devote a lot of attention to. In Shishi, we have rules about not moving the boundaries of other people's fields, which I'm sure doesn't come up too often. Occasionally, land surveys, when one sells a home or has a house survey, that comes up, and there are rules about not moving boundaries on land in very concrete terms. But it also has implications for economic theory, competition. There are always questions about whether the government ought to break up big banks or break up big tech stop mergers from happening, which in a free capitalist society sounds strange. Why is the government interfering in capitalistic processes? But of course, without regulation, there can be economic exploitation. And here there are rules about competition, opening a business on the doorstep of the same business if you're going to take away all their customers, all sorts of regulations that come out of that rule. And then we have in Shvi the beginnings of the rules of war that will come to the fore next week in Parashat Ki Tetzei LeMilchama. And right at the end of this week's parasha, we have the case of the unknown murder victim who is found outside of the city limits. And there is an Egla Arufa, the calf's neck, which is broken by the sages of the town that the body is nearest to, who have to give an announcement, a proclamation that we didn't kill them, which is a tacit recognition that we had responsibility over this wayfarer to ensure their safety on the way out of our city. And in some ways we failed. We have responsibility. We're saying we didn't kill them, but we're confessing that we gave rise to the atmosphere that led to their possible death. A lot more to say, of course. There was more I was going to say, but what we'll do is we'll leave it there. I'll thank you for your attention. I'll thank you for your signing in. And in the meantime, I want to wish you all a wonderful, wonderful Shabbat, a good Erev Shabbat tomorrow. Please, God, keep cool. I know it's meant to be breathlessly hot the next 2 days. Keep cool if you need anything. If, Chip, your lights really do go and your air goes, you should feel free to reach out. I'll send you a fan. And we will look forward to seeing you all soon. Have a wonderful, wonderful night. Shabbat shalom, one and all.
Shabbat shalom. Thank you.
Shabbat shalom. Thank you.